And so today we're gonna talk about Esther. And now this story is a lot different than what you're used to in the Bible. And I wanna say something to you today. I'm not saying The Bachelor is biblical. I'm not saying that. But the story from the Old Testament that we're gonna hear today is more like it than any other book in the Bible. It's more of a rom-com, that means romantic comedy, Michael, if you don't know what that means, or a soap opera, it's much more like that. And while it's not super light and funny, like those typically are, it is insanely ironic, with a whole lot of plot twists, and someone dies, but it's not who you think. And so this is the story of Esther, and it starts off with a party and a beauty pageant. But before we get to all those events, I would ask if you would just pray with me one more time before we open God's word. Father in heaven, we thank you that we get to be with you. Thank you that you're with everyone. Lord, but thank you that you brought us here today for such a time as this. So it's in your name we pray. Amen. So if we will go ahead and open up your Bibles to the book of Esther. And there is a movie about this, but it has like a 19% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I would not want you to waste 2 hours of your life. So let's cover the story here today so you can know the story and see what God has for you here. Don't watch the movie. It's bad. So go ahead, turn your Bibles. And this story takes place, I want to give you some context. This story takes place during the Jewish exile in the Persian Empire under the rule of King Ahasuerus, or more famously known as Xerxes I. And he ruled from 486 to 465 BC, but our story today begins in 483 BC, making this one of the final events that's recorded in the Old Testament. One of the final things we see happen in the Bible before Jesus comes. And the king that we're gonna talk about today, he's a powerful king. The Bible tells us he ruled 127 provinces all the way from India to Kush. And I have no idea where Kush is, but that sounds like a really big span of land. But everything that we're talking about today takes place in one city, and that's the capital city of that empire, Susa. But it's not just about the empire. Within this empire was a lot of Jews that had stayed even after there was a decree written for them. And the Jew we're gonna focus on today is Esther. You see, Esther was a descendant of the tribe of Benjamin, and she was among the many Jews who decided to stay in the empire instead of go home to Jerusalem. But I want us to note that this wasn't necessarily brave. There had been a decree that was written allowing the Jews to go back home to Jerusalem, allowing them to go back to their promised land and rebuild. To rebuild their community, to rebuild their temple, to worship their God. But these Jews that we're gonna hear about today had decided to stay in the empire. And following the death of her parents at an early age, Esther was actually raised by her cousin Mordecai, who's going to be a very important part of our story today. And so, Mordecai worked in the palace of the king. Now, speaking of a palace, I promise you a party, so the background's over. Let's look at how this book starts. The book starts with telling us that the king held a feast for all his officials, staff, and military. And verse 4 tells us that it displayed the glorious wealth of his kingdom and the magnificent splendor of his greatness for a total of 180 days. He threw a party for himself for 180 days. So next time you feel bad for yourself, you know, kind of planning like a low-key birthday dinner, just remember this guy who planned a party for himself for 180 days. So after a six month party for himself to show off to all his friends that definitely liked him a lot, he holds a week long banquet where he invites everyone, not just the people that work for him, but he invites everyone in the city to come to his courtyard, and he throws another party. And there was one rule, according to verse 8, there was one rule. The drinking was according to royal decree. There are no restrictions. Okay, never mind. So there were no rules. There were absolutely no rules at this party. This was not a good king. So moving on, we've gotten to the seventh day of this royal rager. And when he was feeling good from the wine, which is a really polite way to say something, the king calls for his queen Vashti to make an appearance because he wanted to show off her beauty to all the people that were gathered. But the queen refused to come at the king's command. And he was furious. So he started talking to his friends on what he should do. And one of his closest advisors said this in verse 17. For the queen's action will become public knowledge to all of the women and cause them to despise their husbands and say, the king ordered the queen brought before him, but she did not come. Before this day is over, the noble women of Persia and Media who hear about the queen's act will say the same thing to all the officials, resulting in more contempt and fury. And so these guys are like, hey, if you don't get her under control, how are we going to get all these other people under control? So they write up a decree that removes Vashti as the queen, announces a new queen is going to be chosen, and commands all women everywhere to honor their husbands. So now, let's look at chapter 2, the beauty pageant. It had been decided in verse 2, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. And then the young woman who pleases the king will become queen instead of Vashti. And here is where this biblical account turns into The Bachelor real fast. Young women were recruited from every province of the whole kingdom, and they were gathered to this harem where they were under the supervision of one of the king's eunuchs. This was not a good process. And then each one of them would spend one night with the king. That's how it was going to be decided who was the queen. But first, there was a year-long beauty treatment process. Now, some of y'all may think that sounds nice. That sounds terrible for me. It may take more than a year to make me beautiful, but that sounds awful, a year-long beauty treatment process. And so, for 6 months, they would receive treatments of oil or myrrh, and then 6 months, they would receive perfumes and cosmetics, but not for Esther. You see, Esther walked in and stole the show. When she was taken to the palace, she immediately impressed the eunuch, and verse 9 tells us that the young woman pleased him and gained his favor so that he accelerated the process of the beauty treatments and the special diet that she received. Let me tell you what just happened. Esther was the producer's favorite. She was the producer's favorite. And everybody knows that the producer's favorite typically wins The Bachelor, which is something that I would definitely say if I'd ever seen an episode of The Bachelor. But, you know, obviously I haven't because I know nothing about that. Anyways, so she didn't just impress the eunuch. She didn't just impress the eunuch. She actually won. She was chosen amongst all the women to be the queen. And verse 17 tells us this. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins. And so he placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. You see, what had just happened was against all odds. A Jewish orphan raised by her cousin who just worked at the gate had become the queen of an empire. A Jewish orphan had become the queen of an empire. But the whole time, Esther did not reveal her family background or her ethnicity. She was not proud to be a part of the people of God. She doesn't mention it once. And this story is so different from the other Old Testament legends that we've read about. These people that have stood up to powerful, crazy kings. You see, Esther was not Daniel, who refused to assimilate and boldly prayed instead of doing everything else. She was not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that said, I'll walk into the fire before I bow to this king. She made no plans on the front end to stand up for God. It was not in her plan to make this bold stand for God. And you know what's crazy? God's name is not even mentioned once in this entire story. That's one of two books in the Bible where God's name is not even mentioned. And he's seemingly nowhere to be found, as you'll see as we walk through this story. Nobody prays to him. He doesn't talk to anybody. Nobody talks to him. His law isn't kept. Sin's not mentioned. Nothing. Total silence for God and total silence from God. But let's see what happens next. A little later down the road, her cousin Mordecai that we've talked about was sitting at the king's gate because that was his job. He was the gatekeeper. And he learned of a plot to assassinate the king, which is not something that the gatekeepers, you know, typically know about. And so he hears about this great plot to assassinate the king, and he reports it to Queen Esther. She told the king, and then immediately they both gained a whole lot of trust and respect from the king. But here's the thing. He doesn't get any credit for it. After it all took place, the king decided to honor and promote another man named Haman. And you see, Haman, as you'll see throughout the story, is not a good guy, but he quickly rose to the king's number two man. And here on out, you'll hear about Haman and what he does to manipulate the king and try to get rid of God's people. So he's the king's second in command, and the entire royal staff was commanded to bow down and honor him as he passed by. Can you imagine being told that when a person walks by, you have to bow down and honor him? We have no idea how to do that in that culture, but that was what they were supposed to do. But here's the thing. Mordecai refused to bow down. So here we see some heroics start to develop in Mordecai and Esther. Mordecai refused to bow down. But when Haman saw this, he was filled with rage. And this is his response. So now we're in chapter 3, verse 6. And when he learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity, so when he learned that he was a Jew, it seemed repugnant or unacceptable for Haman to just do away with Mordecai alone. He planned to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the kingdom. Simply because Mordecai refused to bow down to him as he passed the gates, Mordecai made a plot to destroy and kill all of God's people. And you see, Haman was not just some random person that worked in the kingdom. Haman was actually a descendant of the ancient Canaanites, who were an old enemy of the Israelites. And so he had hate built in his heart for these people. And to decide the date of when this would happen, he just started rolling dice. That was a lot of times how they made decisions back then. And a dice is called pur in Hebrew. And according to verse 13, he and the king issued this decree. They were going to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jewish people, both young and old, women and children, and plunder their possessions on one single day, the 13th day of Adar, the 12th month. They had a plan to get rid of all of the Jewish people on one day. The story has escalated quickly. It goes from a beauty pageant and a party to then a plot to destroy an entire race, an entire nationality, an entire religion. Haman has a lot of hate for Mordecai and the Jewish people, and he still has a lot of power and influence over the king. But what is still a secret, we've seen everybody else's true colors, but what is still a secret is that those are the queen's people. That's her guardian. That's her cousin. That's her family, her people. So now let's look to chapter 4, where the focus turns to Mordecai and Esther as they talk about how they can fix this. You see, Mordecai is absolutely devastated. He was a proud Jew. Those were his people. And not only was he in trouble, but all of his people were in trouble. And so he begins to mourn in sackcloth and ashes, where they would rip all their clothes off, put just a cloth on, and sit in ashes and mourn and lament. And he did this in the middle of the city. And this great mourning doesn't just happen from Mordecai. It spread among the Jewish people in every province as the bad news reached them about the king's command to kill them. And it said they fasted, wept, and lamented, but there's still no mention of God. They don't say his name. It doesn't even say they prayed. Now, it did say they fasted, wept, and lamented, so you could assume that some did, but it doesn't say it in the account that we're reading. And so, concerned about her cousin, Esther sent somebody to at least give him some clothes. She knew she couldn't make it better, but she just sent some clothes. But Mordecai, being like, hey, I need more than clothes, sends back an urgent message. And Mordecai actually commanded her to approach the king and plead with him for the sake of her people. But there was one big problem. You see, there was a law in that day that applied to every man, every woman, whether it was Esther the queen or Mordecai the right-hand man, and definitely a gatekeeper. No one was allowed to approach the king. No one was allowed to approach the king without being summoned. And if you did, there was only one punishment. They wouldn't try to figure out what your intentions were. There was one punishment, and that was the death penalty. And so, the only way in that day to not be killed by whatever furious king you were approaching was if the king extended his gold scepter and allowed you to live. There was no mercy, there was no grace at this throne. But also, there was another problem. Surely, if anybody could do it, it was Esther. But Esther, the king's own wife, had not been summoned by the king in 30 days. Now, I know some of you guys have had to sleep on the couch for a night, but imagine not being summoned for 30 days. Like, oh my goodness. 30 days. They did not have a relationship. They only had an arrangement. And so Esther did not have the relationship to approach the king. But we know what happened when the last queen tried to. We know what happened when the last queen just refused to show up when she got asked. Imagine what would happen if she showed up unannounced and disagreed with one of his decrees. So when Mordecai hears this, he gives an epic reply and appeal to his dear cousin Esther. And this may sound familiar to you. It's in chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Mordecai told the messenger to reply to Esther and tell her, "Don't think that you will escape the fate of the Jews because you are in the king's palace. Don't think that you're safe. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place." If you keep silent, relief and deliverance will come from another place. But you and your father's family will be destroyed. And who knows? Who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And these are the famous words of the story of Esther. For such a time as this. This is one of the most often quoted verses from this passage. You may have seen it. You may have it hanging up in your house. You may have it in your Instagram bio. For such a time as this. And you see, these words have echoed throughout all of history, all the way to us today and in the Hobby Lobby aisles. But we need to unpack this a little bit more. Mordecai warned Esther, "Esther, I don't think you're safe just because you're the queen. Don't think that you're safe just because you're in the palace of power. You may be the queen, but you're still a Jew." That's what her cousin reminded her. You may be a queen, but you're still a Jew. If you stay silent, though, you know, someone else, something else, somehow relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people. They probably won't all die. They probably won't all be destroyed, but you and your family will be. And he talks to Esther and said, "I will be. You and your family will be." And you see, what we see here is that Esther was in danger, but her silence was even more dangerous. Esther was in danger, but her silence was even more dangerous. "But I don't know, who knows," he says, "who knows? Perhaps you've come to your royal position for such a time as this. Maybe this is why you became the queen. Maybe this is why you're in the king's palace. Maybe this is why, out of all the beautiful young women in all the kingdom, a young Jewish orphan was chosen to be the queen of Persia for such a time as this. But I don't know, who knows, maybe it's a coincidence." He pleads with her, "This is your time." But here's the thing. Relief and deliverance will come somehow, some way, from someone. But here's the question. But why not you? You're in the position to bring it. And you see, I think this is the first semblance of any kind of hope or faith that we see in this story. He sees that there's hope. He sees that maybe they can fix it. But there's still no mention of God. But there's a hope in Mordecai's plea. "Hey, maybe you're the one who can fix this." And so Esther, after receiving those words, she was moved. And she finally gains some courage. And in verse 16, she said this. She starts making plans. She says, "Go and assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa and fast for me." And then she explains what that means. "Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way. And after that, I will go to the king, even if it is against the law." And then she says this, "If I perish, I perish." She said, "Y'all fast, y'all do your thing, I will go to the king. And if I perish, I perish." What an epic exchange of words between the only two Jews in the empire who really know what's going on, who really know a way that they can actually be a part of fixing this. The only way to challenge this cruel king. She says, if I perish, I perish. Which, you know, I think is way more bold than even Ivan Drago's famous line in Rocky IV. If he dies, he dies, right? And that was a terrible impersonation, but that is so much more bold than if he dies, he dies. She said, if I die, I die. And so she plans what the king knows best, like we've seen over and over again, a banquet. She plans a party. And to start chapter 5, she goes to the courtyard. And as soon as the king saw her, because, you know, they may not have spent a lot of time together, but the king still is very impressed with Esther. So she walks in and immediately gains favor with him. And guess what? He immediately offers half his kingdom to her. This guy may be cruel, but he's weirdly generous, you know? She just walks in. He's like, I'll give you half the kingdom. What do you want, babe? What is it, Queen Esther? Whatever you want, even half of the kingdom will be given to you. But she doesn't take up that offer, because she had a different plan, and she just invites him to a party. And she invites Haman. And he asks what she wants still, but she doesn't say what it is yet. She just wants to get them to the party, because, you know, when they're at a party, they make decisions they weren't planning on making. So she just invites him to come to another banquet. They have two banquets in a row. And it says that after getting invited to this party, that Haman left full of joy and in good spirits. He wasn't just a mean guy that was trying to influence the king anymore. He had made it into the royal family. You know, he took a selfie with the king and queen. He was having a great time. He even saw Mordecai, you know, who he hated. And Mordecai once again didn't bow down to him. And it says he was filled with rage, but he was able to control himself. He's found this new self-control. He's found this new purpose. And instead, he goes home to his wife and to his friends, and he starts doing what everybody loves to hear. He starts bragging about himself. He told them about his glorious wealth and all his sons and how the king had honored and promoted him above everyone else. And most of all, how Queen Esther invited nobody but him to her banquet. You see, he was on his high horse, but then he just flips and he changes his mind and he says, you know what? But none of this satisfies me because I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate all the time. This guy had all the power. He had all the influence. He got invited to all the parties. But he saw Mordecai sitting there not honoring him. And he said, none of that satisfies me. So like any good wife and friends would, they give him some advice on how he could better enjoy himself. And verse 14 says this. It says, his wife Zeresh and all his friends told him to do this. I hope you never get this advice. Have them build a gallows 75 feet tall and ask the king in the morning to hang Mordecai on it. And then go to the banquet and enjoy yourself. That's terrible advice. But this advice pleased Haman. And so he immediately had the gallows constructed. 75 feet tall, built with probably the best wood that the kingdom could find. And he finally found the way to just get rid of Mordecai so he could enjoy his royal life. But you see what happens is while Haman was plotting to hang Mordecai, the king couldn't sleep. And apparently even kings can't fall asleep at night. And so what happens was he calls for a bedtime story. This grown man, this king that has everything he wants, he calls for a bedtime story. He really does. And you know what? He didn't want a good one because, you know, he wanted to fall asleep. So he ordered them to read the book recording daily events. That was a book back then. Probably wasn't a New York Times bestseller, but there was a book recording the daily events. And so he asked them, bring me the book. And while this seems silly to us, which it definitely is, something big happened. You see, what they read was the report of how Mordecai earlier had informed them about the assassination plot, if you remember that. And the king asked how he had been rewarded for this act. Did they tell him the story? And he said, hey, what did we ever do for that guy? And the attendants replied, nothing. We didn't give him anything. And here's where the story shifts. We're in chapter 6 now. So let's read starting in verse 4. The king decides he's going to honor somebody. And so he asks, who's in the court? Which is another way of saying, who's in the house, I guess. And so he says, who's in the court? And now Haman was just entering the outer court of the palace to ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. He was looking to honor Mordecai. But Haman walks in, ready to give up that plan to the king, ready to make his final move. And the king attendant answered him and said, Haman's in there, just standing in the court. I don't know what he wants, but. And the king said, have him enter. And Haman enters, and the king asks him, what should be done for the man the king wants to honor? You know, after hearing this question, Haman thought to himself, I mean, who is it the king would want to honor more than me? Who would he want to honor more than me? We're boys. And so Haman told the king this elaborate plan to honor this person. He said, for the man that the king wants to honor, you should have them bring a royal garment that the king himself had worn. You know what? And you should have a horse that the king himself has ridden, which has a royal crown on its head. And you know what you should do? You should put the garment and the horse under the charge of one of the king's most noble officials. And you know what you should do? You should have them clothe the man the king wants to honor, because you know that's definitely me. And you should parade him on the horse around the city square. And you should have that person call out before him, this is what is done for the man the king wants to honor. So the king hears that, tells Haman, okay, hurry and do just as you propose. I want you to take a garment, take a horse for Mordecai the Jew, who's sitting at the king's gate, like he always is, just sitting at the king's gate, not honoring you. You should go and do all of that for Mordecai. And do not leave anything out that you have suggested. So Haman took the garment and the horse, probably very begrudgingly, right? Probably the same way you do laundry, but like way more angry. And so he took the garment and the horse, which I guess none of you use horses during laundry, but I don't know. I know we got some people from McMahon County in the house. What's up? Just kidding. And so he clothes Mordecai, and he paraded him throughout the city square, and he calls out before him, this is what is done for the man the king wants to honor. And then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. He probably walked in feeling pretty good this time. He's not just a gate worker. He's the noble man the king wants to honor. But Haman hurried off for home, mournful and with his head covered. The very person that had led to all of this mourning for Mordecai and the Jews went home crying himself and covered his head. And you know what? This could not be more ironic. He was on his way to the palace. Remember, he was on his way to the palace to ask the king to hang Mordecai. And instead, he had to parade Mordecai, the man he hates the most, around like he's royalty. He was absolutely humiliated about this. But here's the thing. He still was invited to a banquet, and he still had to make it to the party. So once again, the king tells Esther, whatever she asks will be done for her. She walks in, and it's like, I'll give you half the kingdom. He says it again, and this guy is, like I said, oddly generous. But now Esther was actually going to ask for something, and it wasn't half the kingdom. So chapter 7, starting in verse 3, we see Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if the king is pleased, spare my life. This is my request. And spare my people. This is my desire. For my people and I have been sold to destruction, death, and annihilation. And if we had merely just been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept silent. Indeed, that trouble wouldn't be worth burdening the king. And the king spoke up and asked Queen Esther, who is this? And where is the one who would devise such a scheme? He's been totally unaware of all this. And Esther answered, the adversary and the enemy is the evil Haman. And Haman stood terrified before the king and queen. And that's where that picture that I was talking about earlier, where Esther's just like that. And that was her big moment. Now that's a lot more epic than just, you know, that picture. But she says, somebody has planned to do this to my people, and I'm gonna ask you to save them. And so the king was angry, and he stomps out of the room, and Haman just began to beg Esther for his life. You know, he wasn't proud anymore. He was just begging Esther for his life because he knew what the king was capable of because he had influenced the king. And just as he returned to the room, Haman was literally falling on the couch where Esther was reclining, and the king exclaimed, would he actually violate the queen while I'm in the house? And as soon as they said that, they covered Haman's face and took him out of the room, which is never a good sign. In verse 9, one of the king's eunuchs said, you know what? You know what I think I saw outside? There's a gallows that's, 75 feet tall, and it's at Haman's house. And he made it for Mordecai. And the king said, hang him on it. And walks out of the room. The gallows that he had built was the very gallows that he was about to be hanged on. And just like that, Haman was hanged. The story's greatest plot twist yet. The very gallows that had been prepared for Mordecai was Haman's death. What is going on? What is happening? There's still no mention of God. Things are getting crazy. And that same day, you know, the king, he likes his people, but he moves on quick, to say the least, you know. And so he gives Haman's estate to Esther. And then Esther reveals that Mordecai is her cousin. And so the king gives his signet ring that Haman used to wear, just took it off his finger, and gives it to Mordecai. And Esther put Mordecai in charge of all of Haman's estate. And all of a sudden, Mordecai had just totally assumed the life and the leadership that Haman had just earlier that day. He totally replaces him. This was a total switch of power. But there was one more thing. Esther fell at the king's feet and wept and just begged him to revoke that evil plot to kill the Jews. But you know what? It's still illegal to approach the king. But here's what the king does. He extends the gold scepter toward her, the sign of being spared. And so she proposes that they write a new royal edict, an edict that revokes the old one that was written to destroy the Jews. And so Esther now was totally fighting for her people. She had all this courage, and she asked the king in chapter 8, verse 6, for how could I bear to see the disaster that would come to my people? How could I bear to see the destruction of my relatives? And that was the first time we see Esther claim those people as her own. And so the king said, hey, that's not really how it works. Like, you can't revoke a royal decree, but you can write a new one in my honor. And so the king's new edict gave the Jews in every city a right to defend themselves. And the Jews were able to destroy anyone who opposed them. And so this edict, the Jews liked a whole lot better. And so Jews in every province celebrated the good news that reached them. And their mourning, like we've sung about today, their mourning was replaced with celebration. Their mourning was replaced with dancing. And verse 17 tells us, even this happens. It says, many of the ethnic groups of the land professed themselves to be Jews because fear of the Jews had overcome them. I mean, what is happening in the story? Now people are just becoming Jews because they're scared? This was just a total reversal. And so chapter 9 tells us of their great victory in every province. It says not a single people, not a single person could withstand them, and fear of them fell on every nationality. And all of the officials of all the provinces aided the Jews. They didn't just stand by, they joined their team. Why? Because they feared Mordecai. You see, before everybody just feared Haman, but now they were fearing Mordecai. And in their right to defend themselves that day, the Jews killed 75,000 of those who opposed them, including all 10 of Haman's sons. You see, this was more than an upset. This was a total reversal of power and favor. And then, since the Jews were in control, they established a feast and a celebration called Purim, named after the lots that Haman had just recently cast against them, and for the Jewish people to remember these 2 days forever. They established a feast. And how the book concludes is chapter 10 concludes the book with an ode to how powerful the king and Mordecai continued to be. It says he became famous among the Jews and continued to pursue prosperity for his people, and they honored him for it. He became the hero. But this is the story of Esther. From the bachelor to, I don't know, Braveheart. I mean, what a story had happened. What a turn of events. This movie totally changed plots. This was Esther's story. So much drama. From mourning to celebration. From facing annihilation to total victory. And God still hasn't gotten any credit or any recognition. But I think we have to see the gospel is all over this story. God's work is all over the story. And so I share that whole story with you. And if you don't understand why I just told you that whole story, and you don't understand why it's important, I want you to listen to this. Here's what happened here. Here's the point. Despite being in exile in a foreign empire, and despite God seeming to be absent, and Israel really just kind of not caring and being in compromise, still living in Persia, God has not abandoned his promises. God has not abandoned his people, and he's still accomplishing his purpose and his plan. That's what was really happening during all those crazy events that I just shared with you. And that's what I want you to remember. God has not abandoned his people. And you see, Esther's the main character of the story. The book's named after her. It's her courage that inspires us and encourages us to do the right thing at the right time for our people. Esther inspires us to do the right thing at the right time for our people. But here's the other thing she shows us, is to trust that God is at work behind the scenes of our lives, fighting the bigger battles that go way beyond us. Esther did not know this plan when she signed up to be queen. She stepped in at the right time in the right place, but what we see is that God is the one moving behind the scenes, fighting the bigger battles that go way beyond us. And so, I've said over and over again, God is not mentioned. God is silent. But even while silent and seemingly going without notice through this story, I think God is showing us three things from Esther's story. And he wants us not just to look at the events, but to look at him through this story. So here's three things, three insights from the story of Esther. And number one is that coincidences are often God's hand at work. Things that just happen to us are often God at work. And you see, Esther's story has way too many crazy things happen for God to not at least be involved. And you know, on the surface, this could just look like, you know, some ironic coincidences. And if you just read this story in like a book or watched the terrible movie, you probably would just settle at that, like, wow, what a story. That was crazy. But her story has too many coincidences to not be God's work. John Wesley said it this way. He said, "The name of God is not found in this book, but the finger of God is, directing so many events for the deliverance of his people." Esther being chosen to be queen, Mordecai being at the right place at the right time to hear about the plot, the king not being able to sleep that night, Haman's wife and friends convincing him to build a 75-foot gallows, and Mordecai being given all of Haman's power and position. These are small details that have built a grand story. And you see, Esther's story, I think, is similar to many of ours. Her daily life is probably similar to ours, not in any material way. But I think that God's perceived absence and silence is what many of us normally experience. I don't know if you would agree with that. That doesn't sound like having a whole lot of faith. But I think seeming like God is not there and we don't know what he's up to is what many of us typically experience. Because you know what? We don't wake up to a text detailing, you know, how God is going to orchestrate our day for his glory and our good like the Bible promises, right? We don't know how this is all going to work out. But the events of our life and the people in it should be viewed and valued as God's work and the purpose in our life. These events that happen to the people that are in it should be viewed and valued as God's work. So number one is the coincidences that happen are often God's hand at work. And number two is that God gives us influence. God gives us influence, not for our pleasure, but for his purpose. God gives us influence, not for just our pleasure, but for his purpose. And at the end of her story, we see that Esther did not become queen for her own fame and fortune. She isn't even mentioned in the last chapter of the book. Esther became the queen for the purpose of God. And that purpose was to act as an intercessor for her own people. And I love that we've already sang about this and prayed about it and spent time doing it. But if you don't know what that word means, intercessor is a big Bible word that basically just means someone who intervenes on behalf of another. Someone who intervenes, someone who steps in on behalf of another. And you know what? I don't think we view ourselves often enough as intercessors. I really don't. We're so focused on our dreams, our goals, our desires, maybe our resume, that we forget to be others focused and kingdom focused. And we see opportunities that come to us, even really generous ones, as a means to accomplish what we want. And we may ask God to help us, but are we asking God to help others? Do you see yourself as a potential answer to somebody's prayer? Do we see ourselves as able to step in and help people? Because that focus on personal accomplishment and achievement is not of God. It's not from the Holy Spirit. And it's not what God desires for us. God gives us positions of influence for his glory and his purposes. And so I want to ask you today, what position or relationship has God given you to influence and introduce somebody to him? I want you to think about that. Because while Esther did have favor with the king, here's what I want you to know. So did Haman. While Esther did have all this favor with the king, so did Haman. Because there is a battle happening for our people. There are competing kingdoms in this world. And you may be the only person that stands in between the enemy and your friend, in between the world and your family. You may be the only one that stands in that gap. Because you see, Esther wasn't just a beautiful queen. She was a Jewish woman who stood in between these crazy violent leaders and the destruction of her people. And so Haman said to her, who knows? Perhaps you've come to your royal position for such a time as this. And if you know Jesus today, there was something very similar written about you in the New Testament that I want to share with you. Because it wasn't just Esther that had a royal position in a kingdom. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9 tells us, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his possession. Why? So that you may proclaim the praises of the one who called you out of darkness into the glorious light, into his marvelous light. You. That was written about you if you know Jesus. But I don't know if you view yourself that way. I don't know if we view ourselves collectively that way, but I think we have to. I think we have to. I don't want to remind you of something. You are not responsible for building a kingdom. You are a part of a kingdom. You are not responsible for building one. And guess what? You don't have to earn your spot and make your mark to get on the team. You have been chosen, 1 Peter tells us. And who knows, maybe for such a time as this. But while that day Mordecai just said, but who knows, I'll tell you who does know. God knows. God knows why you're here. God knows why you are who you are. God knows why you know who you know. And God knows why it's happening while it happens. But also like Mordecai said, God's will is going to happen with or without you. God's will is going to happen with or without me. God doesn't need us, but he's asked us to be a part. He calls us to be a part of what he's doing. And so I want to ask you, you're already here. Why not be a part of what he's doing? I mean, I guess you could watch, but if you just spectate, you might miss what he wants to do in you and through you. God gives us influence not for our pleasure, but for his purpose. And number three, finally, is Esther points us to Christ. Esther points us to Christ because the whole time while she was interceding for her people, Satan was working behind the scenes as well. Throughout the Old Testament, Satan influenced kingdoms and kings to annihilate the Jewish people, era after era. And in doing so, he desired to thwart God's plan. But you see, Esther's story today reveals that God is more powerful and even more witty than Satan. And he's sovereignly faithful to those who live for his sake. And so, yeah, Esther's the main character of the story. The book is named after her, that's true. But what happens between Haman and Mordecai is insanely profound, and I want you to see it. I want you to see it. The gallows that Haman built for Mordecai ended up being the very gallows he died on. But what was built for Mordecai to die on led to salvation and victory for the Jews. And in a very similar way, the cross, made out of the same material, this wood, the trees that they could find, the cross was built for Jesus to die on. And what was thought to be his defeat was our salvation. It was our victory, first to the Jews, but then to all of us, to you and to me. You see, Mordecai and Esther, they were just trying to protect their family and protect their people. But out of their family and their people came the Messiah, the Son of God, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Jesus came out of this family. And you see, God would not allow his people to be destroyed. He wouldn't do it. Over and over again, he would not allow them because he had a master plan to save them and deliver them. But on earth, Haman wrote a decree to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jewish people. Does that sound familiar? To steal, kill, and destroy. He manipulated the king at every turn to make sure this would happen, just like the devil thought that he could influence every leader and every Pharisee who wanted Jesus dead. He could stomp out the Messiah, he could stomp out God's people and just keep them waiting for something else, someone else. Rome would eventually, you know, probably leave them alone, but then it would be on to the next captivity, the next exile. But if they could just be comfortable in captivity, comfortable not living for God's kingdom, that's right where he wanted them. Haman built the gallows and Rome built the cross. But like Pastor Jordan powerfully preached last week, there is an enemy behind the enemy. There is. But here's the good news for us. God is not silent anymore. He doesn't just work behind the scenes of the story in the Old Testament. Instead of working behind the scenes, he took on flesh and lived among us. And you know what? Jesus wasn't a king that just, you know, changed plans and put somebody else on the cross that deserved it more. Jesus himself stretched himself out on what was planned and made to kill him. And he knew it. And in doing that, he took on all of your sin and mine. And he died. He wasn't a king that just wrote decrees and sent people off and put different people on the gallows. He put himself in the gallows. But what was truly put to death on that day was death itself. Because he rose 3 days later and now is seated at the right hand of the Father where he lives to intercede for us forevermore. That word intercede did not end when Jesus was on the cross. It says that's what he's doing for you right now. But what was truly put to death was death itself. And you know what? That makes the cross not a sign of death, but a sign of the end of death. And the good news in this story, and the good news in the gospel of Jesus is the threat of death has been addressed. Esther interceded for her people. Jesus continues to intercede for you and me. And you know what? I want to ask you two questions. First one is, who do you need to intercede for? Our worship team led us in a powerful way in interceding for the Ukraine. But I want to ask you again. Who do you need to intercede for? Which of your people, your family, your friends, coworkers, whoever, who do you need to intercede for? Because you may have influence with them, but remember, there are competing kingdoms competing for them. There are people competing for our people. But maybe this is the question you need to ask first. And I think this could be the most important question for somebody in here today. And that's, do you need someone to intercede for you? You may not be able to even think about somebody else right now because you need someone to do that for you. And you know what? That can happen today.